Thank you very much. Thank you very much for this kind and bit lengthy introduction. I'm very glad to be able to talk to you to you today. I've been invited or proposed as a topic, the Eurosystem challenges and perspectives. And I'm quite aware that speaking about the European Monetary Union in the UK is a bit like being a missionary in a rather hostile country. But I have been assured of the hospitality of this university. This, at least my nephew Felix, who is studying here, told me about that. And anyhow, I don't want to be a missionary. I just want to give you some information and some facts. And I have to say, I'm very glad to be here this afternoon. I have spent the last 2 days in the city of London. And I have to say, this was what I experienced were really waves of pessimism. And as Mrs. Barber said, depressing situation. So it's good to feel the fresh air of academia and hopefully some more optimistic or positive outlooks. What I want to start with is just some to give you some overview over some economic facts, and of course referring to the international field, so in that sense complementing what Mrs. Barker has already shown. What you see, obviously, so the light blue is 2008. The light red is 2009, and then we have come to 2010. So you see for all major areas, so the euro area, UK, US, Japan, we do see negative growth rates for 2009. I have to say these are the numbers coming from the economic forecast of the European Commission of January 2009. And unfortunately, already now, they may be still be too optimistic because unfortunately, we really have from month to month a downward revision of the forecasts. So you see, we have in all major economies, we have this. There is a hope that in 2010, we will have an upswing or at least an end of the downswing. But as you also see here, it is with very low growth rates. Japan being in a specifically difficult situation, and unfortunately, also the UK being in a rather difficult situation. So this is GDP. Unfortunately, I don't have happiness indicators here, but I thought they would not be very very positive either. So what we have here is the inflation forecasts. And of course, as you see, inflation is dropping down very strongly. The main driver is a rapid decrease in the price of oil and in energy prices in general. And this is really a new phenomenon that we have seen, that things are moving so fast. So if you take the price for a barrel of oil, so at the beginning of 2008, it was 90 US dollar. Then in July, it increased to 140. And at the end of the year, it was 40. So this were really, we have never seen before such abrupt changes. Also never seen before such abrupt changes in the inflation rate, for instance, also in GDP rates. And this is something that as economists and also as policymakers, we have to learn to deal about and also to explain it. We don't have real an explanation why this is so abrupt this time. I have a feeling that this might be an influence of globalization in the sense that, of course, there are no markets that are so liberalized like the capital markets. And also, to a certain extent, oil markets. So that means that the flows of funds, the flows of capital, may move very fast, very strongly, and therefore, on the one hand, lead to bubbles, and on the other hand, leads to very fast declines. And it's really very difficult for us to deal with this. So as you see again, it's again Euro, UK, US, and Japan. We do not expect a deflationary development in the euro area in 2009, but due to base effects, there might be some months in the first half of the year where we do have negative inflation rates. But for the whole year, we think we will clearly have a positive inflation rate. It's much closer in the UK. And what we have learned, of course, is that it is even more difficult to achieve a rate of inflation for a central bank than it is to reduce inflation. All this leads, of course, to the discussion about how are these things going and how fast will this development change. And there we have this famous discussion now in the City of London and elsewhere about love. But it's nothing to do with Valentine's Day. It's L-U-V. So whether it will be a L-shaped development, that means a downturn and a long, prolonged recession. That, unfortunately, is a bit of the Japanese type, this famous or infamous 10 lost years of the Japanese economy, where you had a long period of stagnation, or whether it will be a U-shaped. So that means going down and then after some time going up, or whether it will be a V. So that means sharp downturn, sharp upswing. Unfortunately, I think the V is already out of question. It will be longer. So let's hope for the U. This is exactly what we are thinking about now. Another point that is interesting from the European perspective is that this depression or situation shows a quite substantial amount of divergence. I'm not sure if you can read the numbers, but just if you look at the GDP at the GDP numbers, so we have my own home country, Austria. We expect a decline of GDP of 1.2%. This is bad enough, but it's better than average. And we have extreme cases like Ireland, like Lithuania, with minus 5%, minus in this 6.9%. We have never experienced something like this except in the time of the Great Depression. So these are really kind of free fall. Whereas if you look at the later, at the last, Poland and, for instance, Slovakia, still many or some of the new EU member countries resulting from the eastern expansion of the EU are still the growth centers of the EU. Of course, this still means a substantial decline in growth. Slovakia in 2008 still had a growth rate of 7%. So going down this about 2.7 still is a sharp decrease, but still this is the positives. And this is, without these countries, there would be no positive development or positive, or relatively positive development in the EU as such, and especially Austria is in some way profiting from this situation. If you look at the government deficit figures, what you see is that some countries have achieved deficits that had not been seen as feasible just a year ago. so it will not come as a surprise to you. If you look at the numbers of the UK, with minus 8.8% of the GDP. So if you remember that, for instance, the Stability and Growth Pact has set an upper limit of 3%. So this is quite a very substantial number. And as the fiscal deficits have a time lag in 2010, it might even be minus 9.6%. And again, we really don't know exactly how to deal with these new developments. To a certain extent, they are unavoidable because they reflect automatic stabilizers. But of course, they mean that there will be a huge problematic, or at least huge efforts will have to be made to finance these deficits at costs that are still acceptable to the governments. And just to give you something that was the talk of the town in the city yesterday, even the German government, which is of course the perhaps the bond with the highest ratings and the highest quality, yesterday did not succeed to sell a bond issue of 5 billion in full. Of course, it was a matter of pricing. They were not accepting the higher price the markets wanted to them to pay. But so you see this thing that have been routine, let's say half a year ago, have become a matter of high attention now. And so it's not only the monetary side, it's also the fiscal side that is very relevant and very much under observation now. So looking at it from an economic point of view, one can say, nowadays all governments are Keynesians again. And even if you heard the leader of the UK opposition, it was a very Keynesian-based perspective. The FT has become kind of the stronghold of Keynesianism in Europe now. So it's quite, and I think rightly so, because we are definitely in a Keynesian situation. This is a situation where we obviously have a demand-driven problem, where Mr. Trichet used the Keynesian term of liquidity trap. Also, unfortunately, I think he didn't use it in a very correct way. But so we are in this kind of discussion. And one aspect that might be, and for me personally, is perhaps the most optimistic aspect of it, is that one can say we have learned, economic policy has learned about the experiences of the Great Depression of the 1930s. This is very much so for the US. Mr. Bernanke, as a professor, is really an expert on studying the Great Depression. Actually, when I left as CEO of a bank, of a commercial bank, I had a kind of a cooling off period before going to the central bank, and I used this to go back to university, and I gave a seminar on monetary crisis, which was of course a topic not very quite interesting, but not very far-fetched. And we used Mr. Bernanke's writings. So he really is, and he knows what to do. And I think what we are all concerned about is learning the lessons of the 1930s, doing everything to avoid it. And I think we can avoid it. You know, there is a famous German philosopher who says the only thing we learn from history is that nobody learns anything of it. But I think in this case, we have learned. And this is, I think, the one main point for optimism. That it always takes time. So we have in practically all nations now and all economies, we have some programs to overcome this. It takes time till it really gets full in effect, but then it will work at least to a certain extent. So these are, of course, the challenges of monetary policy that we have. I don't want to go into more detail about this. So what we see is a classical, for the economists among you, Phillips curve constellation, so that inflation is going down when the economy is going down, and this is what we see. The central banks have reacted to this by lowering the central policy rates very fast. You have seen this. The European Central Bank a bit not as fast as others. What we are discussing now is the question, well, what should we do if we approach zero interest rates? And you have just heard before that, of course, this is a rather problematic situation. So central banks, or at least I only can speak for the European Central Bank, we would try to avoid such a situation. But this doesn't mean that we don't have other means to support an economy. So this is all these kind of alternative or unconventional measures come into discussion, and this has been talked about today. So perhaps if it's of interest for you, we can talk about this in the following discussion. So of course, this also has been mentioned that, of course, what we really want to influence are the market rates. And it's again what we call the interest rate channel. So that means the way how central banks can really influence market rates has become weaker, because we have increasing premium for risks. We have liquidity premiums. Again, it's getting better in line, but it's taking some time. So now what I want to talk to you now after this kind of general introduction to give you some ideas about the European Monetary Union. The European Monetary Union has come into effect of about 10 years ago. It was the result of a long economic and political discussion. And the basic philosophy behind it is quite simple. It is the notion that if you have a single European market, it is quite obvious that it is helpful or even necessary to have also a single European currency. Because without a single European currency, what we just see now, we have changes in the exchange rates that are, of course, a hindrance also in some way problematic aspects for the free trade of goods. So it is kind of the logical follow-up of the single European market. The idea, implementation of the European Monetary Union, of course, also had another more political aspect. You are too young to remember this, but before we had the European Monetary Union, most of continental European countries had a policy of fixed exchange rates with the D-mark. The D-mark being the anchor currency for stabilization. And we had what some countries called hard currency policy, or in France, the franc four, which meant de facto that it was the Deutsche Bundesbank that was leading the monetary policy for all of Europe. Which was, of course, not a very good perspective, because especially if you think of it for a country like France, not being too enthusiastic that monetary policy is not made in Paris, but it's done in Frankfurt. So the obvious answer is to have it again in Frankfurt, but not by the Deutsche Bundesbank, but by a pan-European institution. So the effect was, of course, or the main problem was for Germany to give up its own currency. And there are many voices that said that the patriotism of the Germans after the war was a D-mark patriotism, which might be a much even, anyhow, case a much better patriotism than other kinds of patriotism. So it was for them very difficult to give up their currency. Therefore, in designing the European Monetary Union, it was important to design it in a way that is acceptable for the German public. And that means a strict stability orientation. The Deutsche Bundesbank had at its line a strict stability orientation. And this is kind of an heritage that has passed on to the European Central Bank, and I think rightly so. Another point is that, of course, in the context of this strict stability orientation, the question arose, who is allowed to enter this European Monetary Union? And the idea was only countries where you can expect that they will be able and willing to follow this stability orientation. And that is the idea behind the so-called Maastricht requirements. So where you have certain criteria like public deficit not above 3%, stability of the exchange rates for two years before entry, and so on, so that a country has to fulfill to be able to join the European Monetary Union. At the end of the day, I think this big experiment proved to be successful. It was really something that we have no really historical examples for this. It is also with still a lot of political incertitudes, because we do have, at least for the Euro member countries, a unified monetary policy, but we do, and so we have one central bank, but we do not have a unified fiscal policy. So we have one central bank and 16 ministers of finance, which of course is a big difference to the UK and a big difference to the US. Again, this is why the idea was of the Stability Pact. So the Stability Pact of kind of giving cornerstones for fiscal policy. So to make this stability enshrined. The practical work is going on in a very professional way. So the governing council of the ECB consists of the 16 governors of the member countries, plus the 5 members of the executive board of the European Central Bank. So that means that the member countries have the substantive say. This is different from the US. The Federal Reserve System also is a system where you have a number of governors, but in this case, the central governors have the majority vis-a-vis the local governors. So in that sense, this is a decentralized system. And I have to say, as when I entered this group, I was really deeply impressed about the quality of discussion and the preparedness to accept arguments on the argument's sake. It's not necessary a sign of quality, but about a third or even more of the members of the governors of the European Central Bank, of the central banks, have an academic background, so they come from academia, at least in my eyes, this is a positive thing. So in some way, we really have really high quality, almost seminaristic discussions. And it is, if the governor of Luxembourg has a point, it is accepted in the same way as if the governor of the German Bundesbank has a point. So it is really, for me, one of the most positive experience that I have. And now this group, of course, has been challenged in a way that we never dreamt had an idea before what to do. In the days before the crisis, it was very clear ECB was following its goal of price stability defined by the ECB as an inflation rate not more than 2%, but close to 2%, which is a symmetrical goal, because it means it must not be more than 2% inflation rate, but we also don't want to have it much below 2%. So we also want no deflation, and this is something that is a bit forgotten now, although Trichet is always mentioning it and defining it, so that, which means for the time being, our interest is to have a higher inflation rate in Europe to achieve exactly this goal, or at least to avoid deflation. And I think we will succeed in this goal. But anyhow, so what was so obvious, the traditional instruments were not enough. So what the ECB did very fast was to widen the range of acceptable collateral. That means to increase the volume of money. And in fact, the balance sheet of the ECB in the last year has almost doubled. As we all know from economics, this takes time to have effect, but it will have effects, and we see the first effects of it again. Then we had the big shock of the collapse of Lehman Brothers. And I think that nowadays there is consensus, both in politics and in theory, that it was a mistake not to save Lehman, because this really created this feeling of uncertainty, lack of trust that we still have to fight about today. So ECB reacted in a rather quite, I think, positive and flexible way. There's been a criticism of it, not that as fast as the US. And still, as you know, now our official interest rate is substantially higher than the interest rate set by the Fed. There are two reasons for this. The one is that the ECB is very aware that monetary policy has to be seen also in a medium-term perspective. And so not to give the impression that we're acting too in a too radical or perhaps too nervous way about it. The second aspect, and this is also something that might be interesting, especially also for UK students. We do have a substantial difference between the US and, let's say, Europe. In that sense that tax shares in Europe are much higher, that the social systems, the welfare state systems, are more expanded than in the US, and that means that automatic stabilizers are much more stronger in Europe as compared to the US. And therefore, because of this strong automatic stabilizers, monetary policy does not need to intervene in such a dramatic way as it does in the US. So this is one of the causes why we are more on a steady hand approach, but of course still an approach that is reacting to discussions that we have. I don't, I of course run out of time now. So just to give you an overview of the headlines, in the meantime, the euro has become a global player. So in many cases, it has overtaken the US dollar as a world currency. We have had, just in the crisis, the clear experience that being a member of the eurozone means additional security, because it means that you are not affected by exchange rate difficulties, and therefore you don't have to react with your interest rates. But of course, we do have a number of challenges that are ahead, and one of the challenges is, of course, that the euro has, as I said before, this inherent problematic of coordinating monetary policy with fiscal policy, which is more difficult in the euro area than it is, for instance, in the UK or in the US. I think in the long run, what has been shown is that this is a viable structure, that it has even become more stronger during the time the crisis. But as I said, I don't want to be a missionary. I just wanted to give you some information, and I would be glad to discuss about this with you. Thank you very much. Please. What's the problem? So yeah, you're looking for the mic. There is has been somebody.
Thanks for your comments. On the BBC News website, they were saying that financial markets are now pricing in a 1 in 10 chance of the euro failing and breaking apart. What's your assessment of the likelihood of the euro failing as a result of this crisis?
Yes, I know this is a big kind of a parlor game and among some financial circles. I think this is just utter nonsense. Because, excuse me for being so plain, but you see, for the countries that are affected, what is true is that we do have, of course, quite a divergence in the economic developments between, let's say, the southern EU and EMU countries like Greece, like Italy, like Spain, and let's say the western or northern countries. But this doesn't mean that these countries have any incentive to get out of the euro, because if they would get out of the euro, this would mean that they would have obviously a devaluation of their currency, and that they would have to pay their debts now with a devalued currency. That means it would be much more expensive for them to pay back their debts. So this is not a realistic option. And there is no other way. One has to see. We all know, and we had this in all a number of theoretical discussions. If you have a monetary union and you have different developments in productivity and in real unit labor costs, then you will have different developments, for instance, for unemployment. And there are two ways to adjust. Either you have higher mobility, also of labor mobility, or you will have a persistent tendency of higher differences in unemployment. And I think this is a big incentive for these countries to aim at the structural changes that are needed. And this is the way to overcome. And by the way, the differences we have in Europe among, let's say, Germany and Greece are not much higher than the differences, let's say, between California and don't know, New Jersey or something like this. So we do hold, it's an illusion to think that in a monetary union you have a homogeneous real economy. You can live also with a non-homogeneous real economy.
Thank you. I've got a question about Austria, because given the fact that the Austrian banks finance a large part of the Eastern European GDP growth in those countries, do you think now the fact that lots of those countries now go through a downturn, do you think that this represents a risk for the Austrian economy?
I'm very well prepared for this question because I had to talk 2 days about this now when I visited the city. And I think what is necessary is to have a differentiated view. What you have is a few of, let's say, analysts, city analysts and so on, and especially American analysts, that see Central and Eastern Europe as one homogeneous region, which it definitely is not. Start from Austria, and we have one of our neighbors is Slovakia, as I showed you before. This is the country with the highest growth rate in the EU. The other neighbor is Czech Republic, which is a very well-functioning economy. Poland, quite functioning. On the other hand, of course, if you take then Hungary is a country that is in problems. But what we do have in Hungary is that we have just now a program of IMF and EU Commission and to a smaller part also of the European Central Bank kind of stabilizing this economy. So Hungary is an interesting model in that sense that if an EU country gets really into problems, we do have instruments to stabilize it. I think there are a number of questions in the background, so perhaps if you give a chance to the guys over there.
Hi, I want to ask, what do you think the government can do to prevent more and more banks go into difficult situations and the bank can do for themselves? Thank you.
Well, as you see, in the history of the crisis, we had a certain iteration of measures. So the first one was the feeling that we have to increase tier one capital, so that means the core capital of banks, because the problem is that if you have losses, these losses reduce your capital, and if you have to, either you go below the regulatory capital, which is rather rare, or you go below the capital that is demanded nowadays by the markets. So the first point was increase the capital, and this can be done by injecting fresh capital. And in many countries, like in your countries, like in the UK, like in Germany, like in practically all European countries, this has been done by the governments. And the extreme position of part of it is, of course, nationalization. So if you think it's so much capital that you have to inject, then it's just better to nationalize the whole bank. This is the one problem. The second problem is liquidity. Because a bank cannot function, a bank can suffer losses for quite some time as long as the capital is strong enough. A bank cannot function one day without adequate liquidity. So if a bank is not able to fulfill its obligations, it has to be shut the next day. My wife, who is sitting here, knows from own experience that I have been sitting at home at the telephone all night discussing banks, whether we have to close them down or not. And the question really was, do they have the liquidity or is it not available? So therefore the idea was inject liquidity. And one of the ways to do this is to give guarantees for assets so that you need, or for instance, for bank obligations so that the banks can get money from the markets. The third point is on the asset side, this so-called perspective of toxic assets. And there has been a certain illusion for some time with the idea it's all about knowing the exact amounts And if you know the exact amounts of toxic acids, then there will be full information and full transparency, and then banks will trust each other and then things go on. This is an illusion because the notion of toxic assets is a moving target. It all began with some very strange loans in the US, in the real estate sector. It's moving on and on and on. And what we have now is the problems of the real economy. So, of course, that corporate loans might get into problems that were not really some very kind of outlandish products, but that just get less rated because we have an economic crisis. So the problem, the idea that you have a fixed sum of toxic assets is an illusion. It's moving on, and this is one of the big topics we have. We're just discussing now with regulators, and you know there are two main instruments. One is this concept of the bad bank, so that means somebody's, usually the state, taking over the toxic assets. This is, for instance, the Swedish way, but one has to see in Sweden, the government took over the toxic assets only after the nationalization of the banks. So first it nationalized the banks, and then it kind of split up the banks into a functioning part and a toxic part. Or the other approach is some kind of an insurance system. There are very interesting discussions we have had also with the Bank of England, where there are some ideas in this context. So, one has to say in addition, all these systems have to be in conformity with EU law, because they all have to get the approval, at least if they're in Europe, they have to get the approval of the EU Commission. And there are hundreds of very bright minds just at the moment working on this, on these models. And I have to say we have to move fast, because this is really something where the markets await a solution. So there are a number of it, and as I said, it's a moving target, and we will have to work step by step.
What are the extraordinary forms of intervention that the European Central Bank might take in the interbank markets?
Well, if this would call monetary easing or unconventional measures, what is done in the US is that the Fed is buying up directly some treasury bills, or is buying up directly commercial papers. This is also discussed, as you see from the newspapers, in the UK. I have to attract your attention to a not very unimportant detail. All this is done by the central banks with a government guarantee. And this is the problem for the ECB. We do not have one government as a counterpart. As I said, we have 16. So it is the question, who would give, let's say, the securities that we need for such an action? So therefore, the whole aspects are more difficult on the European scale. I think it's not as pressing in the European Monetary Union, because we are in a, let's say, bit of better shape than US, than UK. But of course, as you can imagine, we are discussing this internally, and we will, you also can understand that I cannot tell about, say anything about the results. But it is an ongoing discussion.
I have a question regarding joining the euro. Do you think it is a good idea in time of crisis for Poland to join the ERM now and try to join the euro as soon as possible?
Well, as you may know, it is the intention of the Polish government to do so. And in fact, I think it makes sense, because what we have seen is that in these times of crisis, it is rather easy to attack the currency of a small or medium-sized country. And that would mean a forced devaluation that would go beyond what you really want to do. And if you want to counteract this, you have to increase the interest rate. And that, again, is to increase the interest rate at a time when, in fact, from the real economy side, you would like to decrease it. And therefore, especially for smaller open economies, it does make sense to be a part of the European Monetary Union from an economic point of view. Like in many other countries, also in Poland, there is a political discussion. It needs a change of the constitution, so I don't know whether they will be able to manage this. We have a very similar discussion in Denmark, where there is also an interest from the economic policy side to join the European Monetary Union. It needs a referendum. I don't know what would be the outcome. So there is a certain divergence, but from an economic point of view, especially for small open economies, it makes a lot of sense to be part of the UN, of the European Monetary Union.
My question is, what ways do you see of improving the coordination of fiscal policy? Do you think more sanctions or stricter sanctions or more centralization would be necessary in the future? Because the fact is that a lot of countries have not followed the Stability and Growth Pact.
Well, as you have seen from the numbers I've shown you, in the year 2009, the majority of EU countries will not be within the lines of the Stability and Growth Pact. But I have to add that there has been a change in the statutes of the Stability Pact last or 2 years ago that allows for a certain flexibility. And I think this is the time where you do have to have this flexibility. I would not advocate to give up the Stability Pact, because I think the Stability Pact has an important role as a guideline. And in the medium term, it is necessary to have this, and this is de facto a coordination that we have. But in the situation as we have it now, I think we need we need a certain flexibility. Also, again, as you have seen, there are, of course, some countries that are so far out that, frankly speaking, I'm not sure whether there is really still room left for fiscal policy. He's strong, has the mic.
We've had another speaker at the summit claiming that Trichet is a madman for how he handled the monetary policy in response to the crisis. So with hindsight, do you regret in any way the way the ECB was very hawkish, especially in the summer, in not lowering the interest rates? Or do you think it still fulfilled its mission of stability in the best way? And secondly, aren't you concerned about the current so-called beggar thy neighbor policies that some European countries are trying to implement? And it seems that this was something of the past, maybe of the 60s and 70s, and that nowadays we wouldn't have to resort to those policies again. Thank you.
Well, first, I really do regret very much that I didn't attend this lecture. It would have been quite interesting to hear, but I think it is utterly wrong. You can discuss whether it was the best move to increase the interest rates last summer. One has always to reflect that, of course, the ECB sees as their, and this is the statute that we have, the main responsibility is price stability. And at this time, there was still, of course, quite substantial inflationary expectations. So it was not about fighting a specific rate of inflation, but fighting inflationary expectations. And to tell it very bluntly, to give a signal to the wage movements the autumn of 2008. Then, as I've shown, things have changed rapidly, and I think the ECB has reacted to this quite in an adequate way, also perhaps a bit more cautious than others. Second point, the beggar my neighbor policy. To a certain extent, this is to be awaited. If you have a difficult period of time, of course, it is you get a bit of, let's say, economic nationalism. But this is the big advantage of the single European market. You can have a lot of rhetoric, but it will not have much effect. Mr. Sarkozy can talk a lot about complaining that French companies set up also companies in the Czech Republic. They have done it, and they will do it. So I think this is exactly in these very demanding times, is that we have also a clear legal system of the single European market that counteracts these movements that we have to await, that we have to expect, of economic nationalism.
Hi, you mentioned the fact that during the actual meetings, the governor of Luxembourg has got just as much chance to speak on an issue as the governor of the German Central Bank, for example. I was just wondering, when it comes to actually voting and actually bringing in actual final policy and plan, is there a different skew on the weighting of what different governors vote and suggest? And the other question was the kind of dynamics in the meeting. Just is there a single language, and is it German?
Well, first, I think this was exactly the point that was made it so difficult, especially for the German Bundesbank to join. In this, in the governing council, there is a system, one man, one vote. Unfortunately, I have to say almost one man, because it's only one woman who is part of this. By the way, she's Austrian. otherwise, it's you see, the Luxembourg has the same vote as Germany. To tell, this is the legal side. One always has to say, of course, there is a certain political consensus. The German Bundesbank has one vote. And as I said, the five members of the executive boards are also members of the governing council. And so it is understood that always a German will be a member of, or Germany will have one member in the executive board. So de facto, they will have two votes instead of one. But that's it. So there is no more differentiation. And concerning language, I can convey to you the happy news that it is English what we use. Okay? One. That's it. Okay, I'm sorry for those who had no chance, but we have a very strict...